Up next, a new opera based on the explosion of the atom bomb. Dr. Atomic, at precisely 5:30 a.m. on July 16, 1945, the first atomic bomb exploded in a soaring fireball lighting up the New Mexico desert sky. It was the beginning of the atomic age. And this week, an opera about the atom bomb and its creators opened at the Metropolitan Opera here in New York, called Dr. Atomic, a nickname for the father of the bomb, physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. The opera's libretto is full of physics. And if you read along with it, you get the physics, and it's also full of poetry, because Oppenheimer was not only a scientific genius, he was a highly cultured man who spoke multiple languages. He savored literature, from Baudelaire's poetry to classic Hindu scriptures. And some of that makes it into the opera. And joining me now to talk about this enigmatic physicist and the race to the bomb and how it turns out, all of that. How do you turn all of that into an opera? And we're going to talk about that because I saw the opera. It's really very, very terrific staging. I loved it. I saw it this week. Gerald Finley plays the title role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic, and he's here with us in our studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
And I'll say that again. I'm so embarrassed to have a great voice sitting next to me with my voice here in the studio. John Adams is the composer of Dr. Atomic. He also has a new memoir out now called Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. He joins us over the phone today. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Adams.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And you're welcome. Penny Woolcock is the director of Dr. Atomic. She joins us over the phone from London. Welcome to the show, Ms. Woolcock.
Thank you very much.
John Adams, why an opera about an atomic bomb?
Well, I think that there's no more emphatic a symbol of what we are as Americans, both the good part of our, invention and industry and imagination, and also, our moral standing in the world than the atomic bomb. So opera is a very strange art form. When we go into the theater and the lights go down, we are in a very unreal world. And part of that unreality allows us to address subjects and themes that other art forms are really sort of unable to do in quite the same way. So the atomic bomb seemed like an ideal story, ideal image. And, of course, Oppenheimer is a fantastically interesting character and much, much fun for me to set to music.
And Oppenheimer would be a good choice because he's got so many layers?
Well, of course. Although I understand Oppenheimer only listened to classical music, but he didn't like opera, apparently. But, he was an immensely charismatic person. He was obviously profoundly reflective, thought about what he'd done. And of course, as you mentioned, his deep love of poetry, everything from Charles Baudelaire, the 19th century French poet, to the Bhagavad Gita, which Oppenheimer reportedly read in the original Sanskrit, to John Donne. These are great poets, and I was able to incorporate the actual poetry into the libretto.
Right. 1-800-989-8255 is our number, talking about Dr. Atomic. Gerald Finley, you had to be J. Robert Oppenheimer. Do you have an interest in science? Was this something you'd like to do?
I studied science vigorously as a high school student, and actually was offered a scholarship to Canadian University for biochemistry, which I had to turn down because I also had a place at the Royal College of Music in London. And it wasn't a toss of a coin necessarily, but my life could have been very different.
Mm-hmm. And how did you study this part to be?
Well,
you got the hat right.
Thankfully, there are others that can costume me adequately. Well, it's, of course, so much resource material is available on this extraordinary man. And right the way from television interviews and film snippets and obviously great resource books like Richard Rhodes' The Making of the Atomic Bomb, a number of biographies over the last few years have come out. That provided a fundamental intellectual approach for me. And then, of course, absorbing myself in the material that he himself was interested in, the Bhagavad Gita and the poetry of John Donne and Charles Baudelaire, as John Adams has just said. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get to know that very well. And then I also went to the Pecos Mountains in New Mexico just to get an idea of, and obviously Los Alamos, just to get a sense of geography and physical mm-hmm. kind of relationship that he might have had. So I did what I could.
I noticed in the audience when I was there for the performance, I think saw Freeman Dyson, who's famous, all these famous physicists.
We've had such a wonderful journey these last 3 or 4 years in meeting members of the scientific community who have come to the opera, who have made themselves available for fantastic symposia with us as artists, with their knowledge, obviously, of the specific sciences involved, and also then with the public, kind of unifying us all. And that's been a wonderful journey.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the opera, Dr. Atomic, this hour, and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, with Gerald Finley, John Adams, and Penny Wilcock, who is the director of Dr. Atomic. What was it like for you to direct something science-related, Penny?
Well, I hate to fall into the kind of stereotype gal here, but I have no scientific background whatsoever. And in fact, I went to a girls' school where we didn't even have a laboratory because the idea was that we were just being prepared for marriage, you know. I was offered Dr. Atomic about 2 years ago, but for a couple of years before that, I'd become very interested in the way that scientists think, because I had a boyfriend whose father was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, and he and I couldn't talk to him about his work, but one of the things that really kind of astonished me was that the way that scientists think is very similar to the way that artists think. Mm-hmm. And I had somehow imagined that scientists were very dry and started with a set of calculations and worked their way towards some kind of conclusion. But it became obvious that actually scientists, it's a kind of leap of the imagination. They have these hunches or intuitions or a problem or a question, and then you have a huge amount of work in order to see whether or not your hunch is going to pay off. And that's very similar to the way that we work as artists. So that was something that I'd become really thrilled by, actually. And also, I'd become very interested in Richard Feynman, who's not actually in the opera, but was at Los Alamos and was someone who, you know, could play the bongos and had won a competition in Rio in the carnival, you know, and would do a lot of calculations in strip bars. And that sort of mixture of the sacred and the profane seemed something that I could sort of, you know, relate mm-hmm. to and become interested in.
And a tremendous practical joker.
Exactly, a tremendous practical joker. So I'd kind of read his accounts of being at Los Alamos before the notion of doing Dr. Atomic came up, and it was something that interested mm-hmm. me, because somehow scientists had stopped being these rather dry ivory tower creatures that I had imagined, and I realized that it was this community, very vibrant, cultured, radical people who were extremely thoughtful, in many cases very, very left-wing, you know, and completely not what I had imagined, you know, at the core of making the atomic bomb which was dropped on Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is a number. We're talking about Dr. Atomic, which opened at the Met this week, with Gerald Finley, who plays the role of J. Robert Oppenheimer. John Adams is the composer of Dr. Atomic and the author of a new memoir called Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. And Penny Wilcock is the director of Dr. Atomic. And we're going to take a short break. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Lots of lines open if you'd like to talk about science and the arts. And how do you stage an opera about something, you know, as seemingly difficult and as intricately physical as the atom bomb? Stage it very well. We'll come and talk about lots of those things and the interesting new things on stage, the techniques they used in this opera. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking for the rest of the hour about Dr. Atomic, an opera about the atom bomb. Sitting next to me is General Finley, who plays the title role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic. And here's a little bit about what he was singing about on stage.
Batter my heart, three-personed God, that I may
batter my heart three different ways. It sounded, Gerald, like he was under duress there.
Yeah, that's the moment. That's the moment in the opera when Oppenheimer's alone on stage, and the only other major thing on the stage in this production is is the actual fat man atomic bomb.
The bomb. It really hovers overhead.
Yeah.
Visible
yeah.
almost all the time.
Yeah, and in that particular aria, it's the sonnet, Batter My Heart, Three-Person God by John Donne, and he's pleading effectively for some solace from whatever deity he can search for to rescue his doomed soul.
Mm-hmm. John Adams, you did interweave all these different elements in there, taken from real-life writings.
Yeah, the libretto... Is an extraordinary libretto. We should mention that it's the creation of Peter Sellars, mm-hmm. who did the original production of Dr. Atomic in San Francisco, and with whom I've had a very fruitful, creative relationship that stretches back 25 years now to our first opera, Nixon in China. And in this case, Peter assembled all these quotes, as well as the little fragments of poetry, into a very, very meaningful and dramatically tense narrative. But it's amazing because when Edward Teller sings, he's actually singing Edward Teller's very words. A quote will come from Teller's memoirs, that he remembered happening on that particular night before the bomb was exploded, and likewise passages from General Grove's biography, and I even ended up setting classified documents, that of top secret meetings that had been held, at the Defense Department and the Pentagon in 1945, and have been recently declassified. So it may sound like it's a bit of a cut and paste harebrained collage, but in fact it's not that at all. It really does flow very much like a really gripping drama, and in the middle of all these dialogues, the physicists arguing over the morality of the use of the bomb, or Teller and Oppenheimer fretting at the beginning in scene one over they can't get the fuses on the plutonium sphere to fire properly, and they're really afraid of a fizzle, and it's a multi-billion-dollar experiment even in World War II dollars, and the pressure on these guys was just enormous. Every day there was some frantic phone call from the White House saying, is it ready, is it ready, is it ready? So Oppenheimer, we heard, had literally lost so much weight, he was down under 100 pounds and smoking three packs a day. So, there's a lot of opportunity for musical characterization of this constant state of tension.
Mm-hmm. Penny, the staging was just tremendous. I mean, the innovative use of multimedia. You know, on the way that the stage was, the sets were composed of almost like the walls of an apartment building or an office building laid bare, and the shades all brought down to be used as movie projection screens and rain and all kinds of things.
Yes, well, I come from a filmmaking background, so I was very interested in incorporating filmmaking techniques. But we also wanted the set to be very simple, because you have the desert, which is a huge challenge, you know, to recreate that on a stage, which is essentially a sort of square box, you know. And the desert was so beautiful, and Oppenheimer himself said that his two great loves were physics and the desert, and they were combined in the Manhattan Project. So a way of somehow conjuring up not just the dreadfulness of the project that they were involved in, but also the beauty of it and the excitement. And so we did want it to be a very beautiful set, because on this mesa, on the hill, you had a few thousand of the most brilliant young men, the average age is 25, the most brilliant young scientists in the world, working, as they thought initially, against the clock to get to the atomic bomb before Hitler did. And then the opera opens at the point at which Germany has surrendered, Japan is losing the war, and they know that they're nowhere near getting nuclear weapons, and there's this huge debate over the ethics of what they're doing. And I think that the opera has sort of tremendous resonance now, you know, because knowledge without wisdom is a very dreadful thing. And the things that they were talking about then and were really deep to their own hearts are just as gripping now, you know, both with weapons, but also obviously, you know, cloning and all these different things that are being worked on at the moment, which have tremendous kind of ethical and moral implications.
Mm-hmm. And the music captures that tension that's everywhere.
It's all about the music, really, and John is such a brilliant composer, because it's the first great 21st century opera, and you can hear in it the rhythms of the 20th and the early 21st century. So it's very exciting and very accessible, and I think it does bring something to life and makes us look again at perhaps something that we thought we had understood and digested.
Mm-hmm. Right at the beginning, John, the young scientist Robert Wilson reads a petition urging caution with the bomb. Do you think that scientists have to worry about their repercussions? Was that something you wanted to make, as Penny says, it's a universal worry still today?
Well, I'm often asked that question, and I think insofar as a scientist is a member of the human race, like the rest of us, that they ought to worry about, you know, the repercussions of their experiments. I know that there are some scientists who feel that they should be able to just do what they do and not have any concern with, you know, what other people utilize it for. And, I don't write these operas to take a political stand or to promote an agenda. For instance, you know, I've been living with this story for 8 years, you know, counting the 3 years that I read and researched and the 2 years writing it and then the years in the interim. And I to this day, am not even sure whether the use of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was right or not. I mean, I can see reasons for both sides of the debate. But what I'm trying to do in this opera is bring home the fact that that science is—it's this noble expression, you know, of what the human being can do, what makes us very special in terms of our thinking, our rationality, and our, you know, our control of matter. But at the same time, as Penny mentioned, you know, we're facing this with bioethics, and I also think particularly with the prolongation, the medical prolongation of life, that we can't shy away from the ethical issues that are inherent in every time we make a scientific advance.
Gerald, John talks about how many years he's been sitting with this baby, developing it. You've been involved playing Oppenheimer now for 3 years. Do you find yourself changing your interpretation of it over the years, or looking at it from different light?
Well, I mean, it's a hugely complex issue, and I've had to look at both sides. the opera itself is very wonderfully written so that the arguments are literally presented to Oppenheimer. Why don't we delay? Why don't we give a demonstration? Edward Teller in the very first scene says, you know, we scientists, are working on something so terrible that no amount of protesting or fiddling with politics will save our souls. So, you know, those are the first words in the opera sung by a particular character, and that effectively is the challenge. And okay, we're more informed as material comes from that period, and all the different military ideas being pushed forward, the saving of American lives versus enemy lives. One life is one life, all the way along. We're more informed, and yet the arguments are still very, very, very difficult. Mm. And I suppose that's all I found, is the arguments are even tougher.
There was one scene in particular, a couple of times in that first act, where you have General Grove, who's in charge of the whole shebang, so to speak, admonishing the meteorologist to stop the rain. Stop this. There's a lightning storm going on, right? He's saying, you have the power to stop this. Make it happen or I'm going to hang you, he basically says. And yet then just a few moments later, he starts talking about, gee, how well my diet is working.
Absolutely. I think that's one of correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I think you must have had great delight in composing that particular little vignette. Of the chocolate diet.
What was your purpose in that? Was there a little comic relief here? Was that the real character?
Well, yeah. I mean, General Groves. I admit I do have a lot of fun with him. He's our basso, our buffo, and he's so wonderfully portrayed by our baritone Eric Owens. But, you know, he was a really brilliant guy, let's face it. You know, he took all these enormous engineering challenges, including building the Pentagon. And when Roosevelt named him to take over the Manhattan Project, the only thing people knew was that the nucleus could be split, the atom could be split. But they, you know, they all went and gathered in this remote spot on the Mesa in New Mexico, knowing nothing else, and the fact that Groves was able to make it happen for Oppenheimer is an extraordinary thing. But you know that there's something funny about Groves screaming at the weatherman, but at the same time, I think it points out the fact that, you know, we think we're masters of the universe. Mm-hmm. You know, look here, we can build the atomic bomb, we can send a man to the moon, but we still can't control the weather, or we still can't control our diets. So in certain senses, we're still like infants in the cradle.
Mm-hmm. I think it also brings to life, you know, the way that in any situation, actually, I don't know how many of you have been, I'm sure most of us, to a funeral or have somebody who we love dying. And in the middle of all the great tragedy, there's often kind of very banal things or jokes or whatever. You know, nobody can really sustain that kind of tension. And I think that's one of the things that's really wonderful about the libretto, is that in the middle of all this sort of anxiety about whether the bomb will work or whether it'll ignite the Earth's atmosphere, and whether or not there'll be, you know, Truman will have a Trump card to play with Stalin the next morning at Potsdam, there's somebody worrying about whether or not they're getting fat. And that's really human nature, isn't it? It's what we're like.
Yes, we've all seen that. We're talking about Dr. Atomic this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here with Penny Wilcock, who's the director, John Adams, the composer, and Gerald Finley plays the role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic. That bomb, Penny, it looks so grotesque, so scary up there on that stage. Is that really what it looked like?
That's exactly what it looked like, and it was made by a man in England in his garage, and he absolutely copied the bomb to its last detail. So although, I mean, it's scary and grotesque in some ways, but in other ways it's kind of scarily kind of rinky-dink, really, with all these wires hanging out of it. And there are all these stories about how they were literally sort of stuffing Kleenex and using sellotape in order to keep things in their place. And one of the things that I'd read that really intrigued me was that they, when they had the bomb hanging there, they worried that it might fall down and explode. And so they dragged 16 mattresses to pile up underneath it. This is somehow, you know, going to save them from the bomb exploding. And we had considered using that in the production. I thought, nobody will ever believe us. So I just think we make it up, although we're, you know, trying to make fun of the scientists. But there was a sort of very kind of homemade aspect to it as well, which, you know, it's a good, rather frightening, I think.
Stuff falling off of it, it looks like. You know, yeah, right. It's like a scotch tape. John, last question. Do you think there might be more science operas in you?
You know, I think if you'd asked me the day after I put the final double bar on this after 2 years of work, I would have said, you're crazy. But after seeing, particularly after seeing Penny's production, which very much brings the science to the fore, I'm totally enchanted. And I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if science makes a major appearance in another stage work of mine.
All right. We're going to look forward to it. And I thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Gerald Finley plays the title role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic. He's here with us in New York. John Adams is the composer of Dr. Atomic and has a new memoir out now called Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. He was joining us by phone today. And Penny Wilcock is the director of Dr. Atomic. I want to thank you, Penny, for taking time with us and staying up late to be on our show.
Thank you.
And good luck to all of you in the production.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have Science Friday's Pick of the Week there, and you can see more information about Dr. Atomic and how to go see it here in New York as it completes its run here. Also, you can send us email at sciencefriday.com or surf over to our website where we're podcasting and blogging and doing all kinds of creative things for you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.